pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Good morning. Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show. This is Bradley J., your guest host on day two of two, guest hosting for Mr. Poor, who I believe he was in Cooperstown at the Baseball Hall of Fame yesterday. Had some protesters follow him up there. I guess they listened to the show before. Some of these blue hairs weren't too happy about something going on up there. Who knows what they're mad at. But appreciate you joining today. We're going to have some good guests on later. Kind of a busy-ish summer Friday in politics. Things are pretty sleepy in Montgomery. Flew into Montgomery last night and in Cecil right now outside Pike Road. Happy to be back in sweet home Alabama. Senator Tuberville, our good friend of the program, Coach Tuberville, was sounding off a little bit yesterday on what's going on in Washington. I think he's pretty justified. He's talking about the Save America Act. Of course, that's what most conservatives in Washington right now are focused on. I wouldn't say that's what most Republicans are focused on, because I certainly don't use Republicans and conservatives interchangeably. But Tuberville was talking about the filibuster, and he said, if it takes blowing up the filibuster, I'm fine, if that's what it means to pass Save America Act. Look, it's a bunch of song and dance in Washington. They're not, especially in the Senate, more so in the House. Every single thing that you see, word that you hear, is a distraction. It's a cover up. It's an obfuscation. It's a lie. I mean, we've talked about, till I'm blue in the face, about how everything that Thune's saying about his efforts to pass the Save America Act is just a fig leaf. The majority leader's job today, really, I mean, leader is such a misnomer. You're a true leader has followers, and Thune doesn't really have followers. Give Coach Tuberville credit. Coach Tuberville has played nice with everybody when he's needed to, and you know, his colleagues like him up there, but he is broken from them enough that they certainly don't consider him one of their own, and that's to his credit. We're gonna miss Tuberville in Washington, and I hope that he takes some of that same energy and attitude to Montgomery. I think he will. If he can do to Montgomery what is needed there, he'll be much more impactful as a governor than he is as a senator. I mean, obviously, it would be on the state level, but I mean, the degree to which the lobbyists just pull the strings in Montgomery, it's even far beyond what happens in Washington. In Washington, certainly, I mean, you look at these members of Congress, these senators, but I mean, they rely on these young staffers, especially in the House. It's just, you know, these 20-somethings who maybe don't have a lot of experience. They rely on crafting talking points, and even oftentimes they're given legislation to champion by leadership. But so many of them, they depend, these staffers, they depend on lobbyists. That's where they get their information. That's where many times they get bill or amendment text. A lot of that is not necessarily nefarious, although there's certainly a lot of that, but a lot of it is because it's just these young people, and I mean, there's so many issues going on that you have to look elsewhere to get some expertise and some help on these issues. It's a completely different world in Montgomery. In Montgomery, you've got the lobbyists who just, I mean, call all the shots. The big mules is Big Jim Folsom. I believe he was the first one to coin that term. But it's a different world there, and I can tell you there are a lot of lobbyists who are shaking in their boots right now, shaking in their Gucci loafers, because Tuberville's coming to town, and they're worried about how much he might change things up there. It's much needed. We're going to miss Tuberville. I'm hopeful that Barry Moore can come in and capture a little bit of what Tuberville did. Love Barry, worked for Barry for a little while. I mean, if you look at him in the House, he definitely voted right more often than not. One misconception about Congress, the House and the Senate, voting is such a small part of what a member of Congress does. I know that sounds counterintuitive and that's not the Schoolhouse Rock version of things, but how many votes of consequence do these members even take in a week or a month? It really isn't many. So much of the work goes on behind the scenes because the only legislation that really gets passed is must pass legislation. And when I say must pass, I mean funding the government, which almost always comes late. You're supposed to fund the government in 12 appropriations bills. They never do that on time. They never written by the appropriations committees in time. They're never voted on individually in time. They always have to package them together and try to get them through, usually after a shutdown or at the very least a continuing resolution that keeps the previous fiscal year's funding going for a little while. Sometimes they have to pass two or three continuing resolutions just until they can work up some kind of agreement. And then beyond the appropriations bills to keep the government open, your other authorizations, your yearly NDAA, the National Defense Authorization, the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which of course the deep state loves so much because of some of the domestic spying powers that really shouldn't be in there. Every 5 years or so, they're supposed to pass a farm bill. They usually have to do a 1 or 2 year extension. I believe we're operating on a farm bill extension right now, but that's really all that gets passed. And so the effective legislators are the ones who can maneuver behind the scenes, get the provisions that they want in the underlying bill, because, I mean, you don't even vote on amendments. Who can effectively move the needle before things get to the floor, mostly whether it's in the committee process or working with leadership or however. There are all kinds of different ways. Congress is very complicated in how it works. And then beyond that, of course, the legislative function, even if they don't vote often, the legislative function is supposed to be the most serious prime function that a legislative body has. But beyond that, and this is, I almost say it's more important now than ever. I'm not sure that's the case. It's always been important. But you're supposed to be able to move the needle on issues that matter, especially in the Senate. That was one thing that Jeff Sessions did so well when he was a senator, is he was able to move the needle nationally on so many of these America First issues. And a lot of times, he was out in the wilderness eating locusts, preparing the way for Trump. It seemed like a lot of times, if you talk about immigration and border security, you didn't have anyone talk about reducing legal immigration or protecting American workers. And certainly there weren't any Republicans. The chamber just ran things back then, those Chamber of Commerce style Republicans. Workers only existed for the employers back then in the Republican Party. Jeff Sessions was out there just nonstop talking about how we needed an immigration policy that kept working Americans' wages up, that didn't flood the market with cheap labor for these big corporations. He was talking about, I remember in 15 and 16, Syria was the big global headache back then, and you had Republicans and Democrats who basically wanted to depopulate the entire region of the Middle East of all its male working age population and bring them into the United States as refugees. You had Sessions out there making very intelligent but simple arguments against that. I mean, he said it's not compassion to depopulate an entire region of the people who should be standing up against these regimes. I mean, how's that going to work? And do we even, are we able to vet those people bringing them into our country? And what would the consequences be here for Americans' personal and economic security and far beyond on issues of trade? I mean, Republican orthodoxy back then, it's hard to remember now because this was before the age of Trump. But back then you had Sessions who very humbly went before Alabamians and the American people and said, look, I voted for a lot of these trade deals, and whether it's naivety or trust or whatever, none of the promised results ever came to pass. Every time and time again, Americans get screwed over on these trade deals. And he advocated, that was the big fight over the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was what Obama was trying to force through. And but on so many of these issues, on crime, Sessions wasn't as much of an outlier on that. On the budget, again, I mean, Sessions was out there fighting hard to try to move the needle on the national level, communicating directly to the people on these important issues, so that when Congress actually did vote on these issues, things would go a different way. And I don't think that Sessions gets enough credit for how he really did the hard work that was necessary on those. And I mean, Sessions in so many ways, and obviously I don't need to tell you what happened with him and Trump, but in so many ways, he was preparing the way, preparing the people for that Trump America First agenda. And in that regard, I think that Sessions has been vindicated. If you look at where the Republican Party is today, the Republican Party is much closer to the party of Jeff Sessions than it is to the Republican Party of the John Boehners and the Paul Ryans of the world and the Mitch McConnells. And Jeff Sessions, for that, deserves, I think, a lot of praise, I hope that he's eventually remembered kindly for all the work that he did there. But that's a big role of a senator as well. You've got that national pulpit. I hope that Barry finds an issue that he feels comfortable grabbing a hold of and proactively working to move the needle on. Again, on most issues, I think that he's in the right place. But it's hard. It's hard work. It takes a lot of work to get out there, and not just on media, but working with all these conservative groups and other stakeholders and activists, and to do all that work, most of which goes unnoticed, to actually make a difference. More than ever, that's a big job of a senator these days. And again, I hope that Sessions eventually is remembered for all the work that he did. But regardless, I think that he should be able to sleep well at night, especially when he looks at the direction the Republican Party has taken. There's a lot of changes out there that still need to happen. I mean, if you look at what has happened with right now with Cornyn and Tillis, Sessions' former colleagues, man, it's a mess right now. You still have some Republicans who want to protect their small little fiefdom and don't see the existential crisis that's facing our nation right now. But we'll be right back after a short break. This is the Jeff Porter Show. Cecil, Alabama, this morning. So last night I'd just boarded my flight to come back to Montgomery, and I got a text from someone at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the NRSC. Got some friends over there. I think that for the most part, they understand that I'm not the NRSC's biggest fan, but got some friends over there. But they sent me a photo of Troy Jackson, or who appeared to be Troy Jackson. If you remember, Troy Jackson is the person who the group of Democrat delegates in Maine, it was, I think, just under 600, but they chose Troy Jackson to replace Graham Plattner in that Senate primary. He totally got the Kamala treatment. So good for Troy Jackson. He was able to go from finishing third in the Democrat primary for governor to being just appointed, elevated Kamala style to be the Democrats' choice for to run in the general election in November against our good friend Susan Collins. Ugh. But yeah, I got a photo of this restaurant not far from the White House. Troy Jackson sitting there dining with someone. I couldn't see who. The big news yesterday was Troy Jackson apparently has a couple of kids with his second cousin. Yeah, children with his second cousin, which, look, Alabama, we get mocked for certain types of activities from time to time, which is unwarranted. And I know when I'm outside of Alabama, I hear it and it ticks me off. I try to be a good ambassador of the state when I'm in foreign states. But man, I mean, that's a really wild story that this guy has, and apparently in a long career in politics, this was never anything that was an issue. But now that he's running for a federal office, it's popped up. But one of my friends in the media, we co-host shows on Newsmax from time to time, known him a long time, but Matt Foldy actually accosted him in the restaurant, filmed it, posted it on X, asking questions about him and about his relationship with his second cousin. I don't think that I would have done that. That's just, look, we give the left a hard time for when they treat Republicans like that. I know that, well, but my former boss, Stephen Miller, he can't even appear in public in Washington anymore. I know that many cabinet officials, and this isn't really something that's been reported, they try to keep it under wraps, but many cabinet officials, I mean, they have to move every several weeks because of the harassment and the threats on their lives. So I don't know if I support that kind of treatment, but the Democrats, once again, in the challenge to nominate a normal male to run for office, they fail once again. Just unbelievable. You've got the Plattners of the world, this Troy Jackson who apparently has kids with his second cousin. You've got Tallarico in Texas of all places. You think that's, I mean, in Alabama, I'd like to think we think of Texas as somewhat of a normal state, but man, you wouldn't think so, judging by this Tallarico guy who talks about there are six genders and God doesn't have a gender, and I mean some of just the additional wild statements that he said. Plattner is a good example, and of course he's kind of been sidelined, at least for now. I don't think elected office is in his future, but this is who Washington Democrats think of as like a normal white working class male. I mean, this Plattner guy, that was why they elevated him. But I mean, he'd never had a job outside of apparently oyster farming for one client for his mother's restaurant. He'd bartended in Washington, D.C. He just basically posted online all day. This is who Democrats in Washington think is normal. Whew, reveals a lot about their party. We'll be right back after this break. It's the Jeff Borshow. Throw
Just this time, little doctor, you'll ride a black tornado across the western sky, rope an old blue norther and milk it till it's dry, bulldog the Mississippi, fence ears down flat, long before you take this cowboy's hat.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show. This is Bradley J filling in for Jeff. Up now, we have a very special guest, another friend of the program. We have Mr. Will Hampson on the line. Will, how you doing today, brother? Do we have Will? We may not have Will on yet, but we'll get to him in a minute. We were just talking earlier about the Democrats' ultimate failure to nominate a normal candidate, a normal person who isn't just an alleged rapist or doesn't have children with his second cousin or believe that God might be a woman or not have a gender at all. Just really wild stuff. But if you look at Republicans, there really isn't – like, Republicans should be thriving right now, but they're not. Thankfully, Elon Musk is coming in to bail Republicans out. He's revived his America PAC, and he is spending over $100 million in Alaska, Iowa, Maine, Michigan, and Ohio in Senate and House races. I mean – the NRSC, or one of their allied groups, just announced that the biggest buys that they've made so far are in Ohio and North Carolina. Look, I get North Carolina. That's still a purple state. Republicans are kind of in trouble there. But Ohio? I mean, Senator John Husted was appointed by the governor there, Governor DeWine, who's not really a friend to President Trump. They have a tenuous relationship. He's out there arguing for that we need more Haitians on quote unquote temporary protected status to stay here. But John Husted, man, there I know there's some folks in Washington who really wish that he would actually start campaigning so that all these millions upon millions of dollars that we're having to spend in Ohio, of all states, a state that has turned safely red, all that money could be sent elsewhere if Husted and some of these other Republicans like him would actually campaign. But right now we've got Will Hampson on the line, so we're going to talk to Will. Will, how you doing, brother?
Bradley, doing great. Appreciate the chance to join you.
Yeah, always good to talk with you. It's so fun to watch these Democrats. And look, you and I know Republicans have their own set of problems. But Troy Jackson, and you know, he's got kids with his second cousin. Tallarico's just a loon. What is it about the Democrats today and where the Democrat Party is? Why can't they nominate someone who is even remotely normal?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Bradley, and I think Republicans have started to kind of fall victim to this too, but they're almost trying to put up people that they see as kind of checking all of the boxes, right? I mean, these are people that, Tallarico is supposed to be the guy that can connect with white Texas men, something that they've been lacking. We saw it with Beto O'Rourke for multiple cycles where he was the guy that was going to jazz up the base and excite people. And he brought a manly presence to Texas Democrat politics. It was the same thing with Tim Walz, right? This was, average Joe school guy, coach, who was going to be able to connect with voters. And it turns out when you let consultants try to kind of create these candidates in a lab, you get a lot of inauthenticity. And you also get clearly a lot of baggage. And I hope that Republicans realize that when you try and kind of hand pick the perfect person to win a certain race, when you try and go into a lab and say, we need this, 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 and this to win in this place, and then you go out and you find a Tallarico type or a Tim Walz type, doesn't always work out. The consultants are not very good at picking people that voters will like. In fact, the voters really have shown that they want to be the ones to pick who their nominee is. And look, I think a John Fetterman is a perfect example, right? I mean, someone that obviously has done some things that Republicans have been big fans of. But this was a guy who had literal brain damage, who could not go out and debate in a sense that we know debate. And voters said, we really don't care. We're still going to elect the guy because this is the person that we picked through our process. I think the voters have made it very clear that they're really sick of the consultant types coming in and saying, this is the kind of person we need, and we're going to manufacture it inauthentically. Voters have started to really reject a lot of those kinds of types of candidates across the country.
Yeah, and Will, I mean, this consultancy class, we talked earlier about how Plattner was who they view as like a normal white male. I mean, working class white male. This was a guy who'd never had a job, who spent all his days just posting online. I think part of the problem is that the consultancy class in Washington looks down upon the people that they're trying to message to, and that doesn't make for compelling candidate choices. It doesn't make for like compelling ads, I don't think. It's very much like when they're doing this, it's very much like a Netflix movie approach. You know, Netflix movie, they have to check all these different boxes. Like, you have to have a LGB whatever character. You have to have, a white guy and a black guy, like a buddy comedy. Just like all the movies are so formulaic. And I don't know if there's an easy answer for Republicans or Democrats to kind of go around that, other than just to kind of turn things over to the voters. Is that right?
Absolutely. And look at the successes, right? I mean, you look at a Paxton in Texas who looked at a race and said, I'm going to be running against a guy that has hundreds of millions of dollars. He's going to have all of the consultant support. He's going to have all of the establishment class support. And he said, I'm going to have the voters. And he was right. He was able to win purely because voters said, you know what, we're actually really sick of all of these other things that we're told are really important. We don't care who has the most money. We don't care who has the support of the Washington senators or any of the consultancy class. We're sick of our people going up there and doing nothing. And that's the big thing, Bradley. And I think we know this, right? Republican consultants in particular have gotten really good at finding ways to convince voters that their candidate is super conservative, and then finding ways to also convince them why the past 2, 4, 6 years, however long they've been in office in that term, why their complete failure to do anything resembling conservative policy is actually not the case. They've gotten really good at that. And if you are, generally speaking, a Republican and you have two options, either A, be the conservative candidate who has a really good conservative record, or B, be the candidate who has all of the establishment money and try to convince people that you've actually been conservative when you haven't, I would pick option B every time, because it's clearly that seems to be the easiest path to getting reelected. Voters need to be, I think, a lot more willing to hold people accountable. And that's what we're starting to see. That's why I'm so optimistic standing here. And a lot of this is due to the great work that you guys are doing at Breitbart in exposing the fact that, no, some of these guys actually really aren't conservatives. And in fact, they've done just as much damage to the conservative movement as most Democrats have. If you're looking at this, John Cornyn has been probably more destructive to the conservative movement that Donald Trump ran on and promised than most Democrats have.
Well, and a lot of these guys like Cornyn make our work at Breitbart simple. Just today, he reposted an article, an op-ed that his terrible colleague from Utah, John Curtis, had written talking about how he wasn't going to change the filibuster and we can't change the filibuster. It was just a few months ago in March where John Cornyn wrote his own op-ed in some conservative paper. I don't remember. One who he actually talks to. He won't talk with Breitbart very often. Talking about how we have to do whatever it takes to pass the Save America Act. If that means destroying the filibuster, so be it. And it was this was in March. That was early in the morning. And, I mean, just later that morning, I mean, before he'd even have the opportunity to have a second cup of coffee, he was confronted by a reporter in the basement of the Capitol, and he went back on that. He kind of flip-flopped and was a little wishy-washy on it for the remainder of that campaign. But now here he is advocating for the exact opposite of what he did when it was in the campaign. And like voters see this, despite what the consultancy class think, voters aren't stupid. And he's kind of ruining things for the rest of his colleagues. Like, I mean, all these other establishment Republicans, when they're running for re-election, Republicans are going to see what John Cornyn did, and you got to think that that's going to make it even easier for these challengers to these others. Am I reading that right?
100%, Bradley. And look, here is, I think, the greatest thing that I've seen come out of the second Trump administration. In the first Trump administration, they despised him. They all hated him. But they did it because they thought there were no repercussions. And if you're looking at this now, even, you know, take like a Lindsey Graham, obviously, you know, rest in peace. I hope, you know, his soul is in a good place right now. But he was another one who was not very conservative. He was on the ropes in his primary cycle this year. You have Cornyn. You have, for the very first time, some of these guys that go up there and vote against the interests of their voters finally being exposed, and some of them being held accountable. And I think the greatest thing, Bradley, we know, right, and this is where I'm willing to give a little bit of respect to the Senator Curtis types. At least these guys come out and effectively say, I hate Donald Trump. I hate the Trump agenda. I'm going to fight it. At least they're honest about it. My frustration is the 30 or so senators that absolutely despise Donald Trump, who will go on Hannity and claim to be the most conservative pro-Trump person out there. The frustrating thing for a lot of voters, which I think they're finally starting to realize, their elected officials hate them. They despise that they have to go back to normal places in their states and try and explain to voters why they've accomplished nothing and, in fact, why they've actually been a hindrance to conservative government. They hate that. They don't feel like they have to answer to the people. Do you think Richard Shelby ever believed that he had to be held accountable to the people of Alabama? Absolutely not. He was accountable to the Business Council of Alabama. He was accountable to the people at the University of Alabama who put his name on all of their buildings. But he wasn't an average Joe voter. He didn't give a rip what that person thought about the trillions and trillions of dollars in spending that Richard Shelby was responsible for. That's not an aberration. Most of these guys up there absolutely despise Donald Trump. They hate the agenda. And they hate that their voters would ever hold them accountable for that because they think that they know better than the voters do. They know better than we do. And that's changing. It's a lot harder now. And again, it's due to a lot of really great work by the Breitbarts of the world, by the 1819 Newses of the world, who are finally kind of willing to say, look, we don't need, you know, the general establishment funding for our outlets anymore. We're going to tell the truth. We're going to report. We're going to dig. And we're going to show what's really going on. And if at the end of the day, voters get upset at these people because we're holding them accountable for what they're doing, then so be it. But this is really a new thing. This wasn't a thing in Trump 1. You had all these guys, the Paul Ryan types, the Mitch McConnell types, who fought him tooth and nail, and everyone just went, eh, shucks. Now, some of these guys are being held accountable. And I think we're in Washington, Bradley. We're kind of on the inside here. A lot of these guys are scared for the very first time in their careers. And I think that's a really great thing to see.
Now, Will, in fairness, Shelby didn't always make these universities and tech centers and all put his name on these buildings in exchange for him appropriating money for them. In some instances, he made them put his wife's name on there. So we need to be fair to Senator Shelby there. There are a remarkable amount of Dr. Annette Shelby buildings in the United States for someone who was a professor at Georgetown. But you're right, there's a big change, not just the rise of conservative media, but the rise of, I don't even think social media is the right name for it anymore. It's evolved to be more than that. I mean, there are many reporters and independent journalists out there who just use nothing but what we call social media. It's easier than ever to get your message out if you're one of these challenger type Republicans or Democrats who's coming after these establishment type candidates. It's easier to raise money or reach voters directly. Things are changing quickly. Voters are wise to the fact that they actually can go around these normal channels and elevate these types of politicians who are more in tune with them. You're right, Will. It's an exciting time. Appreciate you joining us today. That's Will Hampson, and we will be right back on the Jeff Moore Show. Walk away from trouble if you can. It won't mean you're weak if you turn the other cheek. I hope you're old enough to understand. Son, you don't have to fight to be a man. There's someone for everyone.
Make a little loving, a little turn of loving on a Mason-Dixon line.
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show. This is Brad J. filling in for Jeff. We're wrapping up the first hour here. We've got the text line up and running. 251-343-0106 is the number there. 251-343-0106. We've got Martin who said amen to what you're saying about Jeff Sessions. Jeff is a patriot, and I've got a lot of respect for him, and very proud to have worked for him for almost 7 years. I understand a little of the reasoning why Trump felt so betrayed by Jeff recusing himself, and that's a whole nother issue that I feel like that is Sessions' story to tell, how that happened. It's not mine. Maybe he'll tell it one day. I certainly don't know everything about that happened. But part of the reason that Trump felt so betrayed is because Sessions was, for so long, it seemed like he was his only defender out there. I mean, he was the first senator to endorse him, of course. He stood by him through all the all the attacks from the left and from Republicans. Those are the most significant attacks. I mean, Sessions, he still doesn't get the credit for, he was Trump's ambassador in Washington. He spent so much time reaching out to these other senators and advocating for Trump and convincing them that this is the direction the party needs to go. We need to shed some of these weights on us in the form of these Chamber of Commerce Republicans who are calling the shot, and become a working class party, an actual party of working Americans, the folks who do the work. Sessions is a real one. So when he recused himself, who did he recuse him? Who did he put in charge? Sessions was not the one who called for the Mueller investigation, who appointed Mueller the special prosecutor. It was Rod Rosenstein. Sessions, when he recused himself, that investigation was put in charge of, or the person put in charge of it was Rod Rosenstein, who, it's important to note, was nominated by Donald Trump. It was Rosenstein who made the decision to install Mueller, but the reason why Trump had it out for Sessions so much was because Sessions for so long had been his only defender, the main guy doing all the work. He'd relied on Sessions for so much during that campaign. He relied on Sessions so much during the transition. Stephen Miller, who was my boss in January of 16, joined the Trump campaign. Man, that was a tough job to have to try to fill his shoes. I tell you that Rick Dearborn, Sessions' chief of staff, was in charge of the transition. I mean, Sessions did so much for Donald Trump and for the Make America Great Again agenda. I hope he can hold his head up high. We'll be right back for the second hour of the Jeff Ford Show.